So the translation. Ramananda Roy continued, according to the Bhagavad Gita, one who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments or desires to have anything, is equally disposed towards every living entity. In that state, he attains pure devotional service unto me. Commentary, of course, by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this verse from the Bhagavad Gita, it is said that a person who accepts the theory of monism, being always engaged in empirical philosophical discussions about spiritual life, becomes joyful and is relieved from all material lamentation and hankering. At that stage, one is equipoised. He sees all living entities as spiritual beings. After attaining this elevated stage, one can attain pure devotional service. The conclusion is that devotional service mixed with ritualistic fruitive activity is inferior to spiritual service based on empirical philosophical discussion. Om Agyanam Tiridam Dasha Janang Janashalakaya Taksho Om Minichamena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam He Krishna Kuruna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Tagapate Gopisha Gopikanta Ratakanta Namostate Tatsakanchana Gorange Vada Vrindavanishvare Vishabhano Satu Devi Panem Hami Hai Priye Vatsakalpa Tarubhascha Kriposim Muri Vacha Patitanan Pavaniriyo Vaishnaviyo Namo Namaha Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swamiti Namine Namaste Sasvati Devi Gurvani Pacharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Pashachare Satarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasiddhi Gaurabhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So before I kind of start to unpack and dissect the purport, let's look at the context, because I always feel it's very important to look at the context of who's speaking, where they are, and why. And obviously this is a transcendental conversation between Ramananda Roy and, of course, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, naturally. So let's learn a little bit about the historical kind of context here of Ramananda Roy. So prior to leaving Jagannath Puri, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had insisted that the Lord meet Ramananda Roy on his travels. Sri Chaitanya had noted this, and upon reaching the banks of the river Godavari, he saw Ramananda Roy arrive with a large royal entourage. Although an influential and powerful governor, Ramananda Roy was also a great devotee. When he saw this effulgent sannyasi of Mahaprabhu, he eagerly stepped forward and received a loving embrace from Sri Chaitanya. It resembled the emotional meeting of two old friends. They conversed with great eagerness and resolved to meet that very evening for further discussion. Sri Chaitanya posed various questions to Ramananda, extracting the essence of Vaishnava theology, including the science of Varna and Ashram. And he urged the royal devotee to go deeper and still deeper. Through that encouragement, Ramananda was able to present the most profound and esoteric conclusions of spiritual love between Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan. A river of unprecedented nectar flowed from Ramananda's mouth, which Sri Chaitanya relished for 10 consecutive nights. So obviously, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a very great listener as well. And we find that when he was Nimai Pandit as well, when he was very young, he was listening to others, and then afterwards, he had understood everything. Sri Chaitanya then requested Ramananda Roy to relocate to Jagannath Puri, where they could continue discussing topics of Krishna. However, before departing, the Lord, out of his mercy, offered a final blessing to Ramananda by revealing his combined form of Radha and Krishna. So Ramananda Roy, he collapsed in ecstasy having seen this. So very, very special personality. That's why I wanted to mention a little bit about the context. Because Ramananda Roy was no more than a mere local governor. He himself was very much central to Lord Chaitanya's Leela. Even though he wasn't a member of the Panchatattva, or he wasn't a renouncer in a sense, he was greater than that. He was well conversant with the intimate pastimes between Radha and Krishna, and knew all the science. And as a governor, in the beginning, before he delved deeper and deeper into the pastimes in Vrindavan of the Lord, he was also talking about the importance of Varna and Ashram, which for a governor, someone involved in a little bit involved with the work of a kshatriya or the work of politics, let's say, he needed to know. So he started off with just general formation of society, and then Lord Chaitanya, dig deeper, let's get to the essence. And he got there. So Ramananda Roy was rewarded with the combined Radha-Krishna form, which to us, of course, is evidence that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the form. Oh, where's the painting gone? Anyway. That's the impersonal Brahman, by the way, which we'll get into later, actually. But yes, so that's the difference between Mayavadi and devotees. We have to have imagery around us, you see, rather than just nothingness. Otherwise, we get bored and we fall down again into this material pool. But yes, so imagine, use your imaginations that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is there, but he's actually the combined form of Radha and Krishna on the earth. Now to kind of like dig into the actual purport by Srila Prabhupada. It's interesting actually that Prabhupada writes here that a person who accepts the theory of monism becomes joyful. And now normally we associate monism with an impersonal thing. But actually in the verse itself, it says Krishna is the supreme Brahman. So you've got Brahman as in basic Brahman realization, the impersonal Brahman. But then you dig deeper, as Mahaprabhu was encouraging Ramananda Roy. You dig deeper, you go beyond the sunlight, enter the sun disk, and you meet the personality of the sun. So similarly, the Brahman realization is the sense that all is one, all is connected, there's only one entity, as it were. But actually, you have to go deeper and understand the ultimate conclusion, which is a Chintabheda Bheda Tattva, that there's simultaneous oneness and difference between the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we, the living entities. But there is an essence of oneness as well. There is an essence of that, but there's also difference. Madhvacharya and Ramanujacharya actually had slightly different angles on this, but based on different emphases on dualism and so forth. And then Mahaprabhu came and said, it's inconceivable, but it's both equally. So not very easy for us to understand, but nevertheless, the best example, as I mentioned, is comparing the sun and the sunlight, or fire and sparks of a fire. Yeah. That's very good. Thank you for that, that's very good. So different colours, oneness, but also within that, you dig deeper, as it were, and you find out there's variety as well. And here we go. When one, especially when one is on the higher realization, one becomes joyful and is relieved from all material lamentation and hankering. And indeed, one who has love for Krishna does not have to return to this material world to once again experience form and variety. The form and variety and the attraction we have to this world can only be superseded by superior form and variety in the spiritual world. Because the living entity has hankering for a relationship. And that's where the true nectar and bliss is. Now, another aspect here in Prabhupada's purport towards the end, actually, says the conclusion, Prabhupada writes, is that devotional service mixed with ritualistic fruitive activity is inferior to spiritual service based on empiric philosophical discussion. In other words, Prabhupada, obviously you've got Jnana Yoga as well, he's studying and so forth, but Prabhupada is actually putting fruitive activity, or he sometimes calls it Karma Kanda. He uses fruitive activity and Karma Kanda interchangeably sometimes. Fruitive activity meaning doing activity for fruits, or doing activity with material motivation, material fruits. So this, I often imagine, I mean, this is only maybe my conditioning, but when I think of fruitive activities, I think of people trying to pick the fruits from the Garden of Eden or something like that. And therefore, the, you know, Adam and Eve, they pick the fruits of material contamination and so forth, and thus mankind falls. So an interesting comparison, I thought. But what is Karmakanda, and what is the difference between the two? Karmakanda is, you could describe it, is actually a section of the Vedas. So it's almost like a cultural justification for fruitive activities. In other words, Karmakanda facilitates fruitive activities. But you can have fruitive activities in a broader context as well, in any cultural context. Karmakanda, though, just means how to adjust material happiness or material living within a Vedic concept. And what I mean by that, it says it refers to rites and observances performed by Brahmins in exchange for dakshin. Karmakanda is also a kanda, or section of the Vedas, that involves the performance of ceremonial acts and sacrificial rites for material benefits only. In other words, people want... Oh, excuse me. Radha Gokulananda ki jai, si salami salana ki jai, si salami salami. So even though the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, it is part of the Vedas, and therefore you could say it is to a degree bona fide, it is not deep. Those who are attracted to the Karmakanda section of the Vedas have not dug deeper. They're only looking about how they can maybe make their family situation or the economic situation or their employment prospects or some material or their bank balance or their next life materially better. So they're aiming towards the planets of the demigods, and thus a lot of Karmakanda is aimed towards pleasing the demigods, and so forth. But especially in the Kali Yuga, I think without the chanting of the holy names, there's no actual spiritual benefit. The only benefits from Karmakanda, especially in the Kali Yuga, is that you are giving dakshin to the brahmanas and the temple, which itself, I suppose, is a good thing. But that in itself is not going to elevate one to the full bliss of Krishna consciousness. It's a basic level. It's like an introduction to religion. It's better than doing nothing, so to speak. It's better than breaking the principles and you know, I would fast on this day, give this amount to the brahmanas, do this, do that, you know, this, and samskaras as well are part of that, to a degree. But this is ultimately, without the chanting of Hare Krishna and so forth, then there's no actual potency, and one is encouraged to dig deeper. But at least it can help the brahmanas and so forth. Let's see what else I have to say. I think what I did after that, I looked at the Bhagavad Gita. I thought, because this is a Bhagavad Gita verse, I decided to pluck out times, some sampled times when Prabhupada actually talks about fruitive activities in his purports, and of course in the verses of the Bhagavad Gita itself. But just before we go on, I think what we have to understand about the Vedas are vast. We actually focus, of course, on obviously the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but also the Bhagavatam. So in that sense, we are more Puranic, a Puranic tradition. Whereas if you go to, say, somewhere like SOAS, or a university, or someone like that, for them, Vedas is just the four Vedas, Rig, Sama, Atra, Yajur Vedas. But actually, we don't focus on pleasing Lord Indra or appeasing the demigods. We're focusing on Krishna Bhakti. And the creme de la creme, of course, is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the ABC is the Bhagavad Gita. And the postgraduate study, of course, is Mahaprabhu and the Chaitanya Charitamrita. But the Vedic culture itself is very, very vast and did include Karmakanda as a means of getting the average person engaging in the cultural landscape, which is conducive overall for spiritual elevation of society as a whole, including Varna and Ashram as well, of course. In other words, the be-all and end-all is not Varna and Ashram. But given that most people are in the condition stage of life, it's a very practical way of doing things. And the overall message of the Bhagavad Gita, or one of the main messages of the Bhagavad Gita, is you do your duty for Krishna. You purify it, but you do not do the duty of others. So in one sense, you could say this supports the Varna and Ashram system. The Kshatriyas have their duty, the Brahmanas have their duty, the Vaishyas have theirs, and so on and so forth. But let's go back now and have a look at some of the verses in the Gita. For example, in connection with fruitive activities and karma kanda, in the Gita 241 purport, Prabhupada writes here, when one is engaged in the duties of Krishna consciousness, he need not act in relationship to the material world with obligations to family traditions, humanity, or nationality. In one sense, we have to be careful not to misunderstand that. In other words, we are not materially a philanthropic movement, not materially, but we offer, I suppose you could say, spiritual philanthropy. We are helping people spiritually, and that is at the root. So, for example, devotees, there's quite a lot of devotees actually, who are distributing prasad to people on the borders of the Ukraine, for example, the refugees, and thousands and thousands of plates of warm prasad meals are going out. So, but it's prasad, it's Krishna. You're giving them Krishna, and that's the point. You're not giving them baked bean tins, or you're not giving them, for example, meat or something like that. Devotees are doing what devotees do best in this troubled area of the world. They're distributing Krishna prasad, and which is a very, very wonderful thing. I've been hearing news about that from Hungary and also Poland over the past few days. So we it's not that we're anti-philanthropic, but we have a spiritual angle to philanthropy. We just add Krishna. We add Krishna to our duties. But if we don't add Krishna, we are ultimately not freeing ourselves or freeing the person or the receiver. Prabhupada goes on in that same purport. In Krishna consciousness, all activities are on the absolute plane, for they are no longer subject to dualities like good and bad. The highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is renunciation of the material conception of life. So if we're not telling people about there's anything else, then we're simply not freeing them. We're simply keeping human society within this cycle where there will always be problems. We have to deal with the world's problems at its root rather than superficially. If you're going to, if you see a withering plant in the house or maybe in your garden or something like that, and you see it's withering and dying, so do you put like a little drop on each leaf? Or do you water it at its root? Right? So Krishna is the root, and the leaves are the individuals and the individual needs. So we have to keep Krishna at the center of whatever we do on whatever level it is, and that seeming material activity becomes spiritual. In other words, we are not asking people to retire to the caves in a selfish and unrealistic and even callous way and not care about the world. Rather, we preach, we distribute prasad, we distribute the holy names. And these are very much the scaffolding or the elements, really, of distribute Prabhupada's books, of course, very much central to Prabhupada's mission. Bhagavad Gita 2:41-43, the Gita itself says, men of small knowledge are very much attached to the flowery words of the Vedas, which recommend various fruitive activities for elevation to heavenly planets, resultant of good birth, power, and so forth. Being desirous of sense gratification and opulent life, they say there's nothing more than this. Prabhupada says, people in general are not very intelligent, and due to their ignorance, they are most attached to fruitive activities. However, that said, Gita 3:26 purport, all rituals, all performances of sacrifices and everything that is put into the Vedas, including all direction for material activities, are meant for understanding Krishna. And I think I referred to that earlier, who is the ultimate goal of life. But because the conditioned souls do not know anything beyond sense gratification, they study the Vedas in that sense, to that end. But through fruitive activities and sense gratification, regulated by Vedic rituals, one is gradually elevated to Krishna consciousness. One is gradually elevated. In other words, even with the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, which differentiates it from completely uncultured or fruitive activities not connected to the Vedas. At least the Karmakanda is a beginning. But the purpose is saying, okay, you've made the first step, you're acknowledging authority, you acknowledge that there are things other than you, you need to get their mercy in some way, okay? But then you've got to go further or dig deeper, as the analogy goes, to actually get to the real point, the summum bonum, the creme de la creme of the Vedas. You see, we have to understand, just like someone's at school, you don't go to someone at primary school and start teaching them like they're PhD students, or they start to do algebra at the age of four. Well, actually, nowadays, I don't know, but they're studying, I think they're trying to study code and teach coding to children now. I mean, I can't figure that one out. But anyway, the analogy still is relevant. So in other words, you don't treat a five-year-old like a PhD student and vice versa. Why? Because the audience is different. So if you just have one book for one audience, that's fine. But then those who fit out, who cannot understand it, will simply drop out of religion and therefore ultimately bhakti altogether, because there's no bridge. Sometimes we think of the analogy of bridge preaching. Oh, I'm a bridge preacher, Prabhu. I'm not sure what that means. I think it means like, okay, you're not giving them direct full-on kijai, you know, Krishna consciousness. You're just doing yoga lessons or something. But like a bridge, an example of bridge preaching would be someone who's a yoga teacher, and every now and then they slip in, oh, anyway, you can also chant, and you know, now let's do the Shriya Namaskar. So, but the idea is that we can do bridge preaching has its point, and also the Karmakanda section of the Vedas is a form of bridge preaching to those who are only really interested in sense gratification. But it's not what we're about. It's not what we focus on. Okay, I'm not sure how long my class should be. Prabhu, what time is the best time for all this prize giving and these other things I'm hearing about? You know, only a few minutes. Okay, so what we'll do, we'll continue for another 10 minutes, because we don't want devotees missing breakfast, do we? No. Or myself, for that matter. All right, so Gita 3:26 purport. Actually, sorry, 4:14, I've done that one. One who does not know the transcendental nature of the Lord and who thinks that the activities of the Lord are aimed at fruitive results are as the activities of ordinary living entities, certainly becomes entangled himself. But one who knows the supreme truth is a liberated soul fixed in Krishna consciousness. That's very, very good. I like that. Here's another one. Gita 8:25, purport. Kapila Muni mentions that those who are expert in fruitive activities and sacrificial methods on earth attain to the moon at death. These elevated souls live on the moon for 10,000 years and enjoy life by drinking samaras. They eventually return to earth. That means on the moon there are higher classes of living beings, though they may not be perceived by our gross senses. So Prabhupada here is basically saying that on the moon there are subtle entities beyond our gross senses, where their standard of living is much, much higher than ours. And there's a drink available there called samaras, which is intoxicating, but not like alcohol, but much nicer and much more, I don't know, but it's sense gratification. It's a very, very, samaras is said to be a very, very high sense of sense gratification and therefore distracting. And so if someone is going to the moon, oh, I'll go to the moon in my next life or whatever, then if the chances are they'll have so much sense gratification on the moon with the samaras and everything else that's there, they probably aren't going to be very Krishna conscious. Some are. Some work their way up to Brahmaloka and they continue their spiritual life from there. But I think compared with, it's like, for example, let's say we go, or say someone from a very poor family gets exposed to the standard of living, let's say in Bel Air or Beverly Hills or somewhere like that, you know, or they start, a very poor family get to mix with a much, much wealthier type of situation, they'll be distracted to say the least. And then you're expecting them, they have the palaces, they have the outdoor swimming pool and all these different facilities. And then you tell them to chant their rounds. You know, it's going to be a lot easier to tell a poorer person because there's less distraction, in a sense. So what's going to happen? They are almost certain to, just like someone can fall down from the impersonal Brahman. You see, in the absence of Lord Titania there. If someone is sure to fall down from the impersonal Brahman, one is likely to fall down from the heavenly planets, and Krishna knows what the earth will be like in 10,000 years. My understanding of the Kali Yuga is it's not going to be that nice 10,000 years from now. Yet, let's see. Gita 5.2. The renunciation of work and work in devotion are both good for liberation. But of the two, work in devotional service is better than the renunciation of work. And this, again, that's very fundamental to the conclusions of the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada writes, as long as one is engaged in activities aimed at improving the standard of bodily comfort, one is sure to transmigrate to different types of bodies, thereby continuing material bondage. Yet, in the following, later on in the same purport, without Krishna consciousness, mere renunciation of fruitive activities does not actually purify the heart of the conditioned soul. As long as the heart is not purified, one has to work on the fruitive platform. And that's very interesting, because it's saying that if our heart is not purified, we're going to end up motivated in some way. And at least according to myself, so therefore we need that little bit of sense gratification. We need a bit of encouragement as well on our path. It's not that we should be, we need good association, we need nice prasadam, but we purify our anattas, actually. We purify our relationship with the material world, because we cannot give everything up. We cannot decide we're going to live on a, well, some people can, but we cannot live on a handful of rice a day or live that type of lifestyle, although that is another path. For us, it's about Krishnaizing everything. Krishnaizing our association, Krishnaizing our diet, Krishnaizing what we're exposed to, basically. But just as importantly, giving Krishna to others, because that also is a form of Krishnaizing our conversation and so forth. Let's see. Yeah, so in other words, what Prabhupada is really saying here, and what the Karmakanda section of the Vedas is saying, is that it's saying, yes, it's true, we're not all pure devotees. We're not all pure devotees, and therefore there needs to be a curriculum in order to help us go from A to B, as it were. Just one more, I think, two more quotes from the Gita, I think, before I finish. Gita 18, verse 3. Some learned men declare that all kinds of fruitive activities should be given up as faulty, yet others sages maintain that acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance should never be abandoned. The purport to 18.8. One who's in Krishna consciousness should not give up earning money out of fear that he's performing fruitive activities. If by working one can engage his money in Krishna consciousness, then one should not desist out of fear or because such activities are considered troublesome. Such renunciation is in the mode of passion. So false renunciation, or hippiedom, or whatever you want to say. In other words, just basically not taking responsibility and saying, oh, I'm a transcendentalist, and really they're just lazy. This is what Prabhupada is saying here. Such renunciation is in the mode of passion. The result of passionate work is always miserable. If a person renounces work in that spirit, he never gets the result of renunciation. True renunciation means renouncing, I guess, material things. It doesn't mean renouncing responsibility. How do you renounce material things? You do it for Krishna. This is the essence of bhakti, like that. So you're doing activity, but you're not doing material activity. If you want to go to a cave in the Himalayas and live like that, then good luck to you. I'm staying here. So just to finish off, I think that one thing we do have to be careful of is throughout history, actually, about the history of religious, in all traditions, we find there is sometimes a very superficial way of looking at different religious traditions, where one is overly attached to rules and regulations for a better way of life, but ultimately it is motivated by material means only, from their own society, their own people, their own race, their own family, or their own selves. if it's for themselves or something that's connected to their nation, their family, their company, whatever it may be, then ultimately this is more or less on the fruitive activity platform. So as devotees, we also have to have a universal arm. Just like, for example, Jesus Christ, for example, slipping back 2,000 years here. He was saying that it's not just about the law. Or if I want to heal someone on the holy day, the Sabbath, I shouldn't be stoned and you shouldn't stone others. You know, it's not just about enforced rules and regulations. It's about love. It's about love. You respect and understand and even follow the rules and regulations. But if it's done superficially to control a population or to take away the sense of internal freedom of that population, then what's the use? So the 11th commandment that Jesus spoke of, he said, follow the 10, but the 11th is love one another, you see, and love the God and love thy God. So in other words, that's basically bhakti as well. That's a form of bhakti teaching. But also there's a meaning when one is using any type of religious tradition for oneself or a very, very superficial way of looking at it, then there's no real benefit. It is said to be on the material platform. And that's different from bhakti. So, thank you, Hare Krishna. Does anyone have any comments or questions?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much for your class, Prabhu. I had a question, obviously, just based on what you were sharing, in regards to nature. Because in one sense, we all have like our nature that we've kind of adapted in this lifetime, and you know, based on the lifestyle that we've lived, let's say for some of us who are joining Krishna consciousness, the predilections that have been gathered do have an effect on how we carry on in our path of bhakti. So you know, maybe some people are coming from a place where they've had like a different kind of lifestyle, where maybe opulence for them was natural, or you know, others are coming from a place where simplicity was natural. And it just reminds me of when Srila Prabhupada was in Africa and he was mentioning for some of these individuals just focus on distributing prasadam and chanting the holy name because they can't think about other intricacies because their mind is predominated on meeting their basic needs. So just understanding this, and then when Krishna says in 9.2 that this process is joyfully and blissfully performed, to what extent should we balance our nature or like our lifestyle that we've kind of gathered in this lifestyle with our Krishna consciousness?
Okay, I'll just answer that briefly. The answer is, you kind of answered it yourself in the sense that, yes, we have to balance. Prabhupada, if you know, he was actually very open-minded and he knew that, okay, even in Australia as well, which is not known as a kind of a poor area, he said, mainly distribute prasadam and, you know, or whatever. And that's actually because you're giving people Krishna, or just like I was talking about troubled areas of the world. It's actually a fantastic thing to do, actually. But I guess if you have an audience which not only like prasadam, because even programs at the temple, they may have a retreat where someone's giving a class or there's kirtan, but there's always prasadam as well. But it's a matter of the proportion depending on the audience. And I think in the Kali Yuga especially, I mean, even in the early days in 26 Second Avenue, Prabhupada actually even started off with just cutting up an apple and distributing that, because that's all he had. But then the standard, with help from devotees such as Mother Yamuna and many others, started to improve the standard, if you like, of prasadam. And ever since then, really, prasadam has been a very important part of Krishna consciousness. But if you have an audience which is more educated, or they can read better, or they're accustomed to the philosophical discussion, then obviously that's fine. That's absolutely right. But we also should not underestimate, we should certainly not look down upon those that are just ready for prasadam, because that's actually why we're all here, really. I believe. I'm here.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Because we all need to eat, so therefore what do? You eat something that is Krishna.
Yeah, sorry, one last question. Sorry,
you're hogging it, Prabhu, go on.
My apologies. this is just also in regards to like with preaching, you know, because you obviously talked about like bridge preaching, for example. so you know the way, you know, we mentioned Sadhu Sangha, we take the association of the devotees, and there's even verses that say that, like, I can't quote it, I'll just verbatim, not verbatim, but that, you know, just by associating with the devotees, even if one's not getting any direct lessons, just being around them is purifying and elevates you to a particular platform. So in us trying to outreach, is us giving our association to others enough to help them elevate, or must we also give like high level philosophy? Because in one sense, it seems that if we give ourselves to others like that, they can gradually get...
I think it depends on the audience, isn't it? If you're in an audience where you start kind of talking about, and I've heard it, no offense to any devotee, but I have seen devotees and they, you know, like, guests will come in into the door here. I've seen it happen. I'm not going to say who. It was kind of a Western couple, and they were obviously in the manor for the first time, and they were going, what do I say? You know, 18th century, I believe. You know, they weren't even interested in the Krishna consciousness. And then this one brahmachari starts talking about Ramananda Roy and Lord Titania. And I didn't know Haridas Thakur. He was whipped and stripped in 21 different marketplaces. And, and they were actually literally walking backwards towards the door. And I go, yes, anyway. But we never saw them again because it was inappropriate. That wasn't me, by the way. I think I was the one at the door, actually. No, but I just thought and said, that was wrong. Now, if you have another audience that is you know, especially among devotees or seasoned devotees, that might be okay to do that. So we have to use our common sense. We have to use our intelligence. And Prabhupada was always somewhere, use your common sense, use your intelligence, you know. Sometimes his disciples would go up to him and say, Prabhupada, do this and do this. You know, and at some point, Prabhupada didn't want to be bothered with too much detail. He wanted to designate power to local GBCs or temple presidents and so forth. He said, use your common sense, you know. I would say the only issue with bridge preaching is that as long as you don't stay on the bridge, because what can happen, if you've got more people on the bridge than actually on the banks of the river, then the bridge will collapse. And you end up like changing the essence of what ISKCON is. You end up as a yoga society or something. No, nothing, but you know what I mean? In other words, Hatha yoga can be used in Krishna service. But we have to give our students or a little bit more. And if it's just this association of devotees, seeing someone with tilak or knowing that someone is a devotee can sometimes be enough. I'll tell you a quick story before I end. There was this local rabbi, actually. I won't mention his name, but he took an association of devotees in India. And he knew they were his friend, but they don't talk philosophy. You know, there's no point in that. But he was so inspired, he made a donation to the Lotus Trust because he was inspired. And he said the reason why he did that, and they're doing business in Ukraine. And the reason why he did that was because he liked the devotees. He wasn't asked to do it. He didn't even know the details of Prashad or anything like that. He just thought, yeah, I like those people, so I gave. So that's a good example of someone from a completely different tradition, nevertheless has its own form of bhakti, of course. But it was because of the association of devotees. And I think that is also bridge preaching, yeah. Okay, I think I'll end there. I believe there's going to be an announcement now about relating to Srila Prabhupada's books, and therefore is not even bridge preaching, it's direct preaching. So please continue, and Hare Krishna, everyone.